Because ultimately, no matter what anybody says, the foundations of America are rooted in the genocide of indigenous peoples and the unfree labor and oppression of Africans, African Americans, and Creoles of color. There is no in between. There is no shining that up.
Welcome to Tilling the Soil, a podcast dedicated to discussing the unique successes and challenges of preserving the history of enslaved people in the United States. This is a project of Whitney Plantation, located in Wallace, Louisiana, a former plantation site dedicated to telling the story of slavery from the perspective of enslaved people. Tilling the Soil was funded by a 2021 Rebirth Grant from the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities. Your hosts are Amber Mitchell and Dr. Joy Banner.
Welcome back to Tilling the Soil, a Whitney Plantation podcast, a very special bonus episode of Tilling the Soil, responding to a very surprising but not surprising issue that's happening today here in our world in the USA. I'm Amber Mitchell, Director of Education at Whitney Plantation, and I have some very special guests on top of my wonderful co-host, Dr. Joy Banner, our Director of Marketing Communications. Hey, Joy.
Hi, Amber.
So on top of Joy's constant presence and backbone, who's always a part of the wonderful co-host and colleague as part of this project, I'd like to also welcome our Director of Visitor Experience and Operations, Yvonne Holden. Hey, Yvonne.
Hi, Amber and Joy. Thank you for letting me crash the podcast today.
Of course, anytime.
Anytime. And last but not least, our special guest, as we all know, on every episode of Tilling the Soil, in addition to myself and Joy, we usually have an additional guest. And our special guest today is Wynton Yates, a local lawyer who is also a big deal on TikTok. And so we're going to be here talking about one of his recent videos. Hey, Wynton.
How you doing? I don't know if big deal is, that might be too lofty.
I'm going to say a big deal from my lips to God's ears, you know.
I'll take it.
Well, from here, I'm just going to hand it over to Joy. Joy, let's get started.
Yes. Well, thank you, Amber. And thank you, Wynton, for joining us today during a time which is very, very busy and active for you. Because was it just last week you... recorded a TikTok video regarding a slave cabin that was currently being used as an Airbnb. And so you created a great video detailing your feelings, providing some history on that space, and it just took off and went viral. Before we get into all of that, can you just tell us a little bit about who you are and give us some of your background so we get to know the man behind the TikTok video?
Okay. So, I mean, first and foremost, like I am a Louisianian, a New Orleanian, however you will say it. My family heritage in this state goes back generations, probably to the founding of this state. So when I say I'm vested in the success of Louisiana, I am like truly vested in the success of Louisiana. But me, I'm a husband, I'm a dad, I'm an attorney. Entertainment attorney, civil rights attorney. I'm a nerd. I think that's how I would describe myself if anybody was asking. But that is who I am on a daily basis.
Shout out to nerds, man. We get stuff done.
Right?
Nerds unite. Black nerds unite. Well, so Wynton, how did we end up here talking about what we are going to talk about today? Can you just give us a little background on your video? What made you decide to do the TikTok?
Yeah, sure. So it was late last week. It was either Friday or Saturday. my brother actually put the listing for this Airbnb in our family group chat. That's me, my parents, my siblings, my wife, in-laws. We're all in this group chat. And it was my phone was blowing up and I wasn't looking at it. And then after a while, I was like, oh my, what is going on? Because usually if our family chat is blowing up, it's only one of two things. It's either something that's like hilarious or somebody needs help with something. So I opened up my group chat and I looked at this link that he put in there. And at first I was like, yeah, this can't be real. This is just too outrageous. This can't be real. And before I was an attorney, I was a television news reporter for about 5 or 6 years. So my first instinct was to verify. Let me verify that this is actually real before I start feeding into whatever this is. So I jumped on my computer, jumped on the Airbnb website, and it took me all of 15, 20 seconds to find the posting and verify that it was real. So I start going through it. And as I'm going through it, I'm just like, this is insane. This is just wild that this is actually a thing. So as I'm going through, I'm reading where they're marketing it, saying, you know, this is an 1830s slave cabin that's been renovated to all the modern amenities. And I'm like, how? It just didn't sit right with me. So I think that as Black people, especially Black Americans, when we come across instances like this, we often feel like there's nowhere for us to go or no one for us to tell or report this to or reach out to in these instances, except for family and friends who can sympathize and empathize with what we're feeling and say, hey, I see you. I understand what you're feeling in watching that. And that's about as far as we can go with it. But I just felt like, okay, a creative outlet for this would be just creating a TikTok for it, put it out there, let people see it. I honestly didn't think, but maybe like a couple hundred people might look at it and get, you know, a few comments here and there. And then that would be it. You know, I get it off my chest and then, you know, I go about my day. And then I wake up the next day and it's got a million views. And I'm like, what is happening?
Wow. a million views just overnight. It really happened that fast, huh?
Yeah, it was less than 24 hours because I remember pulling up the video to check the timestamp and it hit a million at like 18 hours.
Wow.
And I was like, this is wild. This is nuts. This is wild.
And so what has been the response from viewers of that TikTok? What's been the comments and the viralness of the video?
So 95% of the comments have been on par with what I was personally feeling when I looked at it. And the fact that this is outrageous, this is crazy. How could anybody feel right about posting, doing this and, you know, making this available as a bed and breakfast? And then within that 95%, there was a lot more comments of like, the people who are actually renting this out and staying in this, like, how do they even feel comfortable in this space? And then there's like a very surprisingly very small number of like trolls, which is going to happen with anything you post on the internet. There's always going to be trolls, which doesn't bother me because half of them are bots anyway. So it doesn't really bother me. There was another small subset of comments from folks who are non-POC that would start out with a comment of like, I'm not really sure why this is an issue. I can see that it is upsetting a lot of people. Can you please explain what the issue is here? In a very like, I'm not trying to be disrespectful by saying I don't see the issue, but I'm saying I don't see the issue. Can you please explain to me why this is an issue? And I feel like it was more international folks that are saying that don't have any context or history of slavery in the Americas that were saying, hey, I'm not really getting why this isn't, I see it's an issue, but I'm not understanding. Can you go a little bit deeper with it?
Well, and since then, speaking about the response, I know that the owner of the Airbnb reached out to you. Can you talk about the response either from, and I don't know, I can't remember if Airbnb reached out to you directly. I know that they made a response. Can you go into a little bit more detail about, again, about the owner's response and about Airbnb's response?
Yeah, I sure can. So Airbnb didn't respond directly to me. They actually responded to one of the many reporters that I talked to. They put out a response and then sent the same response to all of the other reporters. But in that response, they basically said, hey, these types of postings don't have a place on Airbnb. It was that part is just like cut and paste any company's response to getting called out for something like this. And then at the end of it, they basically were saying, we're going to make policy changes, cut and paste from any other company response. But they also said, okay, we pulled down this specific posting, but we're also going to be pulling down all other slave housing, slave associated properties from the platform across the US as well. That part surprised me. I was like, oh, all right. But we've all heard it. And then my response to that, to all of the news outlets that have asked me, you know, what are your feelings on their response, has been, they're just words at this point, until we actually see a company as large as Airbnb actually step up and implement the diversity that they claim to uphold, implement the inclusion that they claim to uphold, implement these policy changes, then we'll give them some kudos at that point, right? But we actually need to see some changes happen, because these types of things continue to happen. When it comes to the actual property owner, when I first met with UJoy on the phone, I had only seen his like written response, which was long and prepared, right? But it was actually maybe an hour ago, 2 hours ago, that he actually called me, and we had a long conversation on the phone, and he gave me some background on how he acquired the property and some of the issues that he was having with the previous owner that led to this issue, and that he actually already had a plan to redo the property in a way that was more educational because of the previous advertising and all that by the previous owner. And I will say that he was extremely humble, extremely open to the criticism of all of this situation. And it seemed as though he was willing to learn and wanted to know about resources and how to best go about handling the property that he now owns.
With this situation and with us being in the Deep South, having plantations all around us, having former cabins or having buildings associated either with slavery or that are important Black cultural assets, I have a certain sympathy, empathy, or I'm trying to have grace, I think is the word for it, for the owner of that Airbnb that is in this situation, right? Because I think for a lot of cases, people don't intentionally use these spaces or incorrectly use these spaces, intentionally trying to be offensive or trying to cause any harm, right? Doesn't necessarily give anybody an excuse, but you know, I think that a lot of people have ended up in this situation, and a lot more people will end up, you know, in this situation. So what is the opportunity that comes from all of this? And how do we move forward? Any ideas about how do we use these spaces, or what kinds of conversations do you think that we can start having, you know, about slavery and these historic sites?
We start having all of the conversations. I think that is one thing that has come from this for me, is that yes, on its surface, this is about a piece of property that was a slave cabin that was renovated and rented out as a bed and breakfast. And we can all see, for the most part, we can all see how horrendous that is, right? But on a deeper level, this really leads into several other conversations. First being just the actual erasure of the history of slavery in this country. And I know I mentioned that in my original TikTok, and I got a lot of that as part of the response that I got, even from Black folks, is that I said that we are in a time where slavery and the history of slavery is being denied. And a lot of people were like, how can you even begin to deny slavery? That's a crazy statement to make. And I was saying, no, that's not a crazy statement to make at all. We've got states like Texas who are trying to change the verbiage of slavery to involuntary relocation. That to me is a direct denial of slavery, a softening of what the slave experience in this country was, changing it from slavery to involuntary relocation, right? I agreed with one of the comments that I got from that calling it involuntary relocation is tantamount to your boss coming to you and moving you from one cubicle to another and you just kind of being upset about it because you don't get to sit next to the window anymore, right? That's what involuntary relocation is. It's not slavery. Totally different things, right? So I think that's one conversation that we should be having is, how do we keep the actual narrative of what slavery was in this country alive and stop softening it to make people feel comfortable with the conversation? Because it's not a comfortable conversation. It never will be a comfortable conversation. It's not a comfortable conversation for us when we're kids and our parents and our grandparents have to have that conversation with us to say, hey, at one point in this country, your ancestors were in chains, right? One of my most vivid memories as a kid is my grandfather and grandmother would take us out every so often and teach us about Black history and slavery and our community, right? And my grandfather had, I think he still has them, he had a pair of shackles from the 1800s. And I just remember him putting that steel in my hands at one point and him just saying, do you feel that? Do you feel the weight of that steel? That is what was around your ancestors' ankles and wrists at one point because they weren't seen as human beings. That's not a comfortable conversation for a grandfather to be having with their grandson, right? So why are we softening it and changing it and, in this case, renovating that history to make it not so bad, right? And I think there were a lot of people that were saying, well, you know, it's still history. It's still, people are still spending time in this space and they can see how it was. I said, no, not at all, because that is not how the slave cabins existed during that time. This is not the way they were. They didn't have clawfoot tubs. They didn't have tile. They didn't have running water. They didn't have electricity. They didn't have, you know, beautiful sunset views. They didn't have peaceful coffee on the porch in the morning. And they damn sure didn't have like vacation vibes of, you know, a couple staying there in a soft bed. It was usually like 10, 11, 12, 13 people in that house trying to survive, right? They were dying in those spaces from being overworked. They were dying from starvation. They were dying from infectious diseases. They were just trying to survive, right? So to have somebody go into that space, spend time in that space, and then come away from that experience saying, hey, that wasn't that bad, is a clear whitewashing of the slave experience, right? So I think that's one conversation we're having. And then from there, we're talking about the building itself. So growing up, I had, you know, non-POC friends that we would go visit, you know, their family lake house, right? And while we were there, their, you know, parents would be like, oh yeah, this was our fourth great grandfather's. He built this with his own hands when he immigrated from such and such and built his business and built this legacy for our family and passed it down, right? That is their ancestral home in America. For Black Americans, the same is not true because our ancestral homes are those slave cabins. And for someone to renovate that is essentially renovating and wiping away the memories and experiences of our ancestral homes that we cannot access in the same way that we might be able to access somewhere like a Whitney plantation, right? And within that same conversation is talking about the fact that for Black Americans, the ability to find out who your family was, your true, real family tree, is extremely hard and extremely traumatic for white Americans. Is as easy as pull a couple of documents, ask some family members, they can put together their family tree, tell you who was who had what kids, where they lived, where they came from, what their stories were, what their experiences were, right? For Black Americans, that's not true because of slavery. And I'm preaching to the choir here, but, you know, obviously slaves were bought, sold, traded, moved from plantation to plantation. Husband, wives were broken up. Children were taken away. Those family units were broken up and spread out. That now, in today's age, it is so hard for a Black family to start documenting their family tree because we don't know who was who and where they were and what their names were. We don't even know a lot of our ancestors' names because they were put in unmarked graves. So we don't know where they were. We don't know what their names were. And then the trauma associated with actually taking the time to build that family tree is going through all of those documents and then going through receipts for your family members that were purchased as like property. And I don't think people outside of the Black community understand the trauma that comes with seeing a receipt for a human being that comes with its own weight, right? So I think this Airbnb situation just opens up the floodgates for conversations that need to be had in many different directions.
From the education portion, Amber, can you speak to how can learning about slavery and the recent effects on slavery education and Black history leads us to situations where we might find ourselves the subject of a TikTok video that goes viral?
So all of it comes down to a long-term misinformation campaign about how we are disconnected from how we as Americans, Black, white, or otherwise, are disconnected from our own nation's history. And all of that goes back to concentrated efforts of keeping this history oppressed that reemerge every few years. You know, so the current culture wars or resurgence of the 90s culture wars about let's not teach this or let's teach this, but only in this kind of way. And let's just add a cutesy name to a really, really horrible event. You know, these are things that have replayed over and over again. But all of it at the end of the day is just a way to continue to have a populace that is disassociated with where they come from and the real foundations of our society. Because ultimately, no matter what anybody says, the foundations of America are rooted in the genocide of indigenous peoples and the unfree labor and oppression of Africans, African Americans, and Creoles of color. There is no in-between. There is no shining that up. It is the beginning and the end of what has created the foundation of our socioeconomic society today. And so by disassociating the terribleness of slavery with the actual physical space makes it even that much worse, right? To say like, oh, well, you know, this wasn't really a slave cabin. It was a sharecropper's cabin. Okay, but what was it before it was a sharecropper's cabin, right? Or, well, what's a sharecropper? Where did they come from, right? What does that mean? What do slave cabins look like when they aren't on a rural site? Because obviously you had slavery in cities, of course, right? What do slave dwelling places look like in non-rural spaces at the same time? But ultimately, I think for all of us, this event just kind of drives home the point that spaces and places like Whitney Plantation are just very, very important. For those of you who are unfamiliar with us, Whitney Plantation is the only plantation site, historic site in Louisiana that is specifically dedicated to telling the story of slavery from the perspective of enslaved people. And so that means from the beginning of your tour to the end of your tour that you are learning about what happened at sites like Habitation Hydel, a 1752 sugar plantation that created the foundation on which we as a society are built today, as an example. And so our role and other historic sites around the country, other places, archives, museums, libraries, whatnot, we have an important role to play in learning and teaching this history and making sure that we are loud in our defense of this history and telling it for the way that it actually was and not for the way that people wish it could have been. You know, I would love to hear about from a hospitality perspective of like, well, what is it like, what even goes into that of deciding, you know what, I'm going to redo a space and sort of take away from it its original context. And Yvonne, I know you have a long background in hospitality for a long time, so I'd just love to hear your thoughts on some of that.
That's a long podcast. I think what I can say to shorten it a little bit, coming from a long hospitality background, so much of the industry is rooted in catering to comfort, the comfort of people, and ultimately removing any tension or potential unpleasant experience that would interfere with said comfort, right? And that is true in hotels, that is true in restaurants, that is certainly true with B&Bs and Airbnbs in the market today. And I think that, you know, that's where obviously a massive disconnect with public knowledge, also, you know, what we've been socialized to feel entitled to as guests in these spaces, but how ultimately the catering to people's comfort ultimately prioritizes the operational and aspects of any business or organization. And so for a site like this plantation in Mississippi that renovated a former slave dwelling into an Airbnb rental, you can very much see that their perspective was the comfort and catering to the comfort of visitors coming to the site from potentially, and, you know, I don't know too much about this site. I did, you know, do a little bit of research when I came across your TikTok and post just to see who these individuals were, also where in Mississippi they were located, and just get some information. And it just looks like a place that ultimately was catered to the old school plantation tourism that deals in people's comfort. And when I say people, I mean a very specific demographic of people. And so renovating this slave cabin was just an extension of their perspective on hospitality, which is not removed from the overall societal expectations of hospitality in this country. And the misunderstanding that, or I shouldn't say misunderstanding, the lack of knowledge that the roots of hospitality are traced back to the history of slavery as well. You know, we see these things converging. We see these things converging every day, even on sites like ours, you know, how we move forward in spaces that cater to the public and what our responsibilities are, you know, especially for us as a site that solely interprets the history of slavery, interpreting the truth of what a plantation is to the public. We definitely have to walk a line between making sure that the public is coming into a safe space, but not crossing the line into a hospitality space where we are catering to physical comforts. You know, it's not to say that we don't run a safe site. We very much do, but there is a line that sort of is drawn with us in the way that I look at, you know, our operations and the visitor experience, which ultimately informs me, this history informs me to be very acutely aware of the difference between making our site accessible to the public and also the difference between that and also making it a comfortable place that erases the history, but also erases all of us as descendants of this history who run the site, some direct descendants. You know, many of our staff are direct descendants of the site. And so how do we as an organization look at this from a space of welcoming people in, but not making the same mistakes as many sites have made and being very clumsy with that? So our awareness on our site has to be more in tune, and absolutely and rightfully so.
Thank you, Yvonne. And going and staying in the vein of hospitality, I think one of the things that me and Linton talked about in our previous phone conversation is that when these spaces, they often use, well, this is the way that we support the site, right? We have to have these plantation weddings, or we book out these cottages. It brings in money for us to support the entire site. And you know, I think what people often are owners of these site, managers of these site often forget is that you have Black people as your audience. We are often at these spaces. And me and Winton talked about the fact that being from the South, that we have been either at plantation weddings, we've been at, you know, social events, Christmas parties, birthday parties, at plantations, right? And for so long, we have stayed quiet out of that respect for, you know, that need to protect white comfort. And, you know, now as we, you know, we are learning more and, you know, we are understanding the implications that Black erasure and white comfort, what that means for us as a Black community, you know, is no longer acceptable. And it's, it has never been safe, but we realize that, you know, this is directly, you know, threatening our safety in some way, shape or form. And so I guess my question to all of you is, what advice would you give to sites that, you know, give us the reasoning that they are sticking to this, like just the commodity model? Like, I don't want to do it, but, you know, I make money. That's my revenue stream. So what advice or what response would you give to site owners that use that as an excuse?
In my personal opinion, I would say that that's a cop out of, okay, so you're using the space for weddings or events or whatnot, but why? But this on like, why? Like, we don't have to necessarily use these buildings in the same way or use these buildings in a money-making way to that extent. Why aren't you thinking outside the box in terms of different kinds of revenue streams that could be garnered from your space and using that space in an intentional way outside of tropes, right? And outside of, I'm just going to keep doing what people want, because ultimately people will use your space in the ways that they ultimately want to, whether you like it or not. But what's best for you as a site, for you as a steward of a site, is that you have to lay the foundation down and say what's doable and what isn't doable. And making that decision of saying, you know what, a plantation is all but a concentration camp. I am not going to allow people to celebrate big milestones that take away from the true lineage of this site, even though this lineage is something from 250 years ago, because ultimately there is blood in the soil here and there is a certain level of respect and fealty that I need to do in order to make sure that the respect stays with this site and the people who made it.
My personal advice and professional advice is for these sites is that they really need to just make a decision about what it is that they are committed to. If they are committed to a truthful telling of the history of slavery, then that needs to be woven into every single operational decision that these sites make. They can't have it both ways. They can't continue. And if they decide, for example, and there are sites who have dug their heels in, we know sites in Louisiana, for example, that have dug their heels in on telling this false narrative of the history of the site so people can continue to enjoy, you know, landscape gardens, you know, and, you know, enjoy dinners and entertainment in these antebellum plantation homes. Both decisions have consequences, you know. I mean, the decision to tell a truthful history, the consequences are, though, are not a negative consequence, because as you all pointed out, and as we know very well, on the whole, once you commit yourself to the truth on a site, you automatically increase your audience, because these sites have not catered towards Black people or even other brown people or indigenous people. Even, you know, the original peoples of these lands were present on these lands that these plantations were built on, you know, and even enslaved on some of them as well. And so when you commit yourself to the truth, you open up the ability to gain a larger audience, but also to don't discount the audience that you think you've been catering to this whole time either, because on the whole, there are many, many people outside of the Black community who do not agree with how these sites continue to operate, but ultimately don't feel that they don't have the courage or have the confidence, I should say better, to speak out about it. And so, you know, so when somebody does come out speaking the truth. And when sites do come out speaking the truth, there is so much overwhelming support. And on the other hand, for the people who dig their heels down, what we understand is that people ultimately who want to continue to propagate these myths about what these sites were ultimately are receiving more and more backlash, you know? And so, but then what do you do if you're a site who thinks you can incorporate both? Well, you pretty much are still on the other side of it. You still are digging your heels into telling a myth about the history of the site. And so ultimately, your first decision is, are you going to tell the truth about these sites or are you not? And everything that flows from there, it'll take time, it'll take effort, you know, because the people who own these sites that have not started telling a truthful history, they themselves need to become educated. So they themselves need to go on a journey. They themselves need to open up these inquiries to the community. Something that stuck with me with what you were saying, Winton, is the owner who called you directly and asked you directly what you thought he should do with these sites. That is an overwhelming inquiry to make to one person, right? You know, and I think that's, we've seen a lot of that happening. A lot of this one-on-one, hey, you're a Black person. What do you think we should do with this site? And I'm just like, oh my, like, I am one person. You need a community of people to reach out to. You need a community of people to give you input. I can tell you this story, but ultimately, I can tell you my opinion, I should say. I can tell you my opinion, but like my opinion, I don't have the bandwidth, time, or even structural support to give you everything that you need. And so the journey will take some time.
And like Winton isn't even a part of that necessarily community in Greenville. Like, why aren't you asking folks who are descendants of that plantation and other plantations in the area of Greenville what to do with this space? I'm sure they could give you a lot more background than you probably know.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And, you know, they may read you a little bit, possibly, for buying the space, which is fine, but they more than likely have a lot more skin in the game than we do as outsiders. Mm-hmm. So why not go to them with a humble heart and offerings to ask them for their opinion and their assistance in transforming
narratives? It's all about the approach. It's all about the approach to the community. Like, if you come to them with your nose up, They're going to return that same energy and say, yeah, you don't actually want to know about our people and what happened here. But if you come to them humble, they will be more than willing to helping you tell the actual story of that space. But one of the comments that stuck out to me the most, because I got a bunch of them, and mostly from our people, Black people on the TikTok, one gentleman said, if we as Black people keep preventing white owners from making money from these sites, these properties, then they will have no choice but to destroy them. And I think I agree with Amber that that is a cop out. That's a straight up cop out, because you are saying either allow them to continue to profit off of Black pain and slavery in the modern day, or destroy the site, which I don't understand why those are the only two options. Mm-hmm. When if you look around outside of the Black community and the Native American community, any other site that is considered historical or historically important in this country or in the world, as a matter of fact, is revered. So if you go to any Great American battlefield, if you go to any Great American anything that doesn't necessarily tie into the Black community, it is owned and run by the U.S. National Forest. It is owned and run by some large nonprofit that has endless money and backers and all this stuff. But when it comes to Black American historical sites, the funding's not there, the support's not there, and the excuse is, hey, if we don't make money on this, we just gotta let it rot or destroy it. And mm-hmm. it's like, well, how do you do it with the other sites? Mm-hmm. And then if you think about it in the same way with these other sites of saying like, okay, cool, I'm gonna rent out this battlefield for my next corporate event, and we're gonna have brunch out on the battlefield, people would riot. They would be pissed off if you were like, yeah, I'm gonna have a wedding on the graves of these American soldiers. They would freak out.
We're going out to Gettysburg and we're gonna set up and have a fish fry
out. They would the electric would slide all over them.
Okay, they would paint it.
I'm there.
But we're supposed to accept that same energy when it comes to plantations of like, yeah, well, if we don't open it up to events and weddings and corporate events and all this stuff, what else do we do with it? It's like, mm-hmm. Well, what else do you do with anything else? You memorialize it and you make a museum out of it in some way. There's so many other things that you can do. You can get in touch with all kinds of organizations, allow archaeologists, anthropologists, other professionals to come in and do research, do digs, find artifacts, like turn this into a space that is of education and not profit. Like, I don't understand how that is that works somehow for other sites and other spaces. But when it comes to Black American historical sites, it's just like, well, we don't know what to do with it other than make money. It's like, you know what to do. You just don't want to.
Yeah. Really quickly, I think this is also like another podcast subject for another podcast, but I think there's also this idea that that people should be able to make money by any means possible, even if that means the continued desecration of the history of our ancestors, right? You know, and I think that it is so indicative of the American mindset that, you know, people just have the right to profit at any cost. And so if what we're saying is that, hey, these sites shouldn't continue to be used as these event spaces that whitewash the history that actually happened on these sites, the response being like, well, if they can't do that, then they're just going to burn down is not, you know, is something that just basically feeds into the idea that, you know what, there's, if you get in the middle of the ability of somebody to profit off of something, there's something inherently wrong with that, you know? And, you know, and it's fear-based, you know, I think sometimes, you know, that response is definitely fear-based. It does speak to a general lack of, you know, just the imagination and also thinking about and valuing like Black history and Black land and sites that ultimately that are a part of our shared history and identity, really.
One of the biggest comments that I got on the TikTok is, well, if the ancestors of these people, the descendants of these people want it to be memorialized or turned into a museum, they should buy the plantation and then do what they want with it. And then that I didn't respond to any of them, but in my mind, I'm like, well, have you heard of redlining, or have you heard of like the fact that the descendants of these people are still dealing with the effects of slavery, the financial effects of slavery and generational wealth, and the fact that they probably are not in a position to purchase a plantation? Like, it doesn't work that way. Like, again, another conversation of like, have you heard of all of these other things that happened because of slavery? Or do you just like saying really dumb stuff and not really thinking about what you're saying?
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's that long legacy of slavery, because the way that we teach it as a culture, as a society, doesn't do it justice to say just what that legacy is, like how we can draw direct lines from slavery to the modern justice system and over policing in Black communities, where we can draw a direct line to redlining, to making decisions about where people can live, what people can buy, what people can spend their money on, who can have babies and who can't have babies, and how many babies can they have, and where could they get the money to feed said babies. Like, all of those things can all be like, it just didn't happen in a vacuum. A lot of what we're talking about all can be headed back to singular events or collective events within our historical narrative and within the United States context, that's slavery. This conversation kind of gets me thinking about what some people might say in response to this conversation, right? So obviously we're a nearly 250-year-old country at this point, right? And so, you know, events happened everywhere. Every piece of land has some event that has attached itself to it, event, land, buildings, whatever, right? And so I guess in my thinking, here's a question for the group. Should former sites of enslavement or other types of difficult history, challenging history, or just history period disclosed if they know what happened there? Should they be bringing that up to the general public for them to make an informed decision about whether or not they should patronize that business, go into that building, spend time in that space? And if so, if we think that they should disclose that, what does that disclosure look like?
I personally think it depends on what that history is when it comes to events like slavery or the Holocaust or the Trail of Tears. Those things are things that we are still dealing with the reverberations of. We're still dealing with the effects of slavery. We're still dealing with the effects of the Holocaust. We're still dealing with the effects of the Trail of Tears. We're still dealing with the effects of those things, right? Because I got a ton of these comments of like, bad stuff happens everywhere. If you shut off everything because something bad happened there, then nothing would be available for the economy, right? I agree with that bad things happen everywhere. I disagree with the fact that those bad things affect an entire community for generations at a time. So one person was like, if you go to Europe, there were wars and blood and all this stuff. And I was like, okay, in what way are you still affected by what happened in the medieval times? In what way are you still affected by any of those events? We are still 2-3 generations away from slavery. I was fortunate enough to know my great great grandfather, who was probably one, if not two steps away from slavery. That's how close we still are to slavery when it comes to Native Americans and their history. They're still in it. That hasn't ended. That's currently still happening. Like, they're still having their lands taken away from them. So that never stopped. Right. And for Black Americans, slavery ended, but the effects of slavery have not ended. So we're still dealing with it. So there are communities in this country that are still dealing with those injustices. And then there are events that happened in history, but are not affecting mass communities in a way that keeps them from being able to buy a home, buy a car, live life, walk the streets without being gunned down by police. Like, those events are not affecting you, your life today. And I think that's the difference between history and like history all the way back there, history.
Yeah, that's such a great way of contextualizing that. Not all history, it doesn't impact us all the same. And then when someone used the beautiful word, you know, perfect word, reverberations, I think that was you, Winton. If it is still active and causing that pain to keep getting, you know, more and more pushed down, internalized and pushed on us, the disclosure is necessary, right? And one of the questions that I had, and I guess this is for all of you, when we talk about these spaces and the different ways that they can be used, the idea of who do you consider to be your audience? And like, what is the complexion of that audience, right? And I think that the idea when we said about all of those ways in which there's healing ways that you can use those species, those different sites, the archaeology, the genealogy, but what it would mean if you are courting or you are being attentive to a Black audience, then that means that you're going to have more Black people at your site, right? And are you comfortable as a plantation owner with looking across your site and seeing it filled with Black people, right? And so I think that, you know, asking those questions, although plantations were Black spaces, right? That's what you would have historically seen that. But because, you know, we're so far removed from the history, the idea of that you have these white people controlling, you know, everything. Yes, they're controlling it, but it's not a site that's going to be overwhelmingly white. And so do you think that And you know, speaking about the trauma and speaking about, you know, different ways in the disclosure, do you think that sites are really ready to embrace the diversity of what their site could potentially actually encourage and actually, you know, have there on their site?
I don't think they have a choice. They have to. Mm-hmm. Like, I think if you're going to take on the responsibility of owning a site that is a former plantation or is a plantation, that comes with the responsibility of ownership, is not only owning the actual physical property, but owning the history that comes with it. You can't have one. They're not exclusive. You can't have one without the other. It is what it is, because the community around there is keeping that history alive, and you're going to be reminded every day of what happened on that site, whether you want to ignore it or not.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Definitely wanted to put it in this conversation when we talk about the protection of white sites and the invisibility of Black sites, and you know the potential or what to do in a, especially again that protection, National Park Service, the National Trust for Historic Preservation, what we have going on in the community that Whitney sits in now, which is my community of Wallace, a small town of about 800 people, of mostly people that are descended from people enslaved at Whitney or other plantations. What we are finding out, because we have land that was historically part of Whitney Plantation, sugarcane fields, and we talked about burial grounds. What we know now is that if there was a plantation, then that plantation had to have a burial ground. And so now we have a grain terminal, a massive grain terminal, that's not only threatening, you know, Whitney, the built environment of Whitney, but also the Black historic neighborhood, which is my own and a couple of others throughout the area. And what we have found out is that industry comes in and no one really looks to see where those Black artifacts are. We are a community that even outside of Whitney, there's still so much for us to be able to build a successful, a sustainable heritage and tourism industry, right? But it's getting people to acknowledge that these historical artifacts pertaining to not only the Black community, but also the Indigenous community, they are worthy of protection. They are valuable. And then just to be able to extrapolate to the fact that if you have a Black descendant community around, you know, a plantation space that where they can trace back their lineage directly to that plantation, then the people themselves are historical and significant, right? And so just to talk to what's happening now and what, you know, our community is facing, and understanding that the protection that white communities get and white historical sites get, and therefore, you know, a lot of white communities, residential spaces are protected because of, you know, they're in the aura of this historic space, versus when it comes to Black people, the idea that if it is not automatically commodifiable, then it can't be significant, right? And I think it's such a linkage back to, you know, Black people and always having to have a price attached to us, always having to prove our value and always having to prove our worth. It's something that is happening, you know, as we speak. So I just wanted to put that into the conversation. I don't know if you have any comments on it or if you just want to leave it there. I just had to say it.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I mean, I live in Central City here in New Orleans proper, which is a historic space, but it's not designated as a historic space. But if you go up the street to the Garden District, that is designated as a historic area of the city, right? I would argue that Central City is more historic than the Garden District, because we had so many historic figures that spent time here, that did things here, that were important to the city and the state of Louisiana, but it does not have that designation as historic, right? Because it is considered low income, because it is considered dangerous, because it is a Black area of the city. It does not have that same je ne sais quoi when it comes to calling something historic, right? Even though it absolutely is. I'm two doors down from a home that should have a historic placard on the front of it, but it's boarded up and caving in, right? Because it's not in an area that people are going to be, it's not St. Charles. People aren't going to be walking around, taking pictures of the homes and looking at the placards, right? But that is absolutely a historic home up the street. That is important to this city. And I think when it comes to Black people and the artifacts of history that come out of our community, artifacts is not a word that people think of when they think of stuff that we have as Black people, right? They want to see the gun that Jesse James held because that's fun, right? They want to see those kind of things because they're fun parts of history, and I get to play cowboy, right? But to see and dig up like the actual shackles of a slave, that's heavy. That's heavy, man. And that's not fun. That's not fun history. So let's just leave that where it is and put industry on top of it and like pretend that that's not there.
Exactly.
So we were just kind of talking a little bit about disclosure, and I just want to bring some attention to a project that I really enjoy, well, not necessarily enjoy, but I really admire out of Germany called the Stumbling Stones Project, mm-hmm. where an artist in 1992 started putting out these little gold squares, gold brass squares in front of the last known home or workplace of a person, a Jewish person who was murdered in the Holocaust. And mm-hmm. They are unassuming. They're just set outside of a building or on a building itself. This little square, it says the name of the person, the dates that they lived there, with the whole goal of the project of it being something that you just stumble upon. You're walking down the street and you just see it to remind people that history happened here, that there was a person who lived here, there was a person who mattered who lived here, who experienced this very terrible event in our collective history. And so let's take a moment to acknowledge the fact that these people were here and that these people existed in that moment. And I think that that could be a really interesting project in the States. And I know I believe there's somebody who was doing a similar project with enslaved people here in the States. I'm not sure if that's still going, but to be able to, if we're going to disclose anything about these buildings, because we recognize the fact that we have limited amounts of space and that it's important to repurpose and reuse space when we can, where appropriate. But I think that it's sometimes that disclosure can be as big as turning a place into a museum or a learning space. But I think it also could be public acknowledgement of the people who lived and existed and loved in this space. Mm-hmm. Give those people, even if you don't necessarily know their names, to give them that respect in terms of admiring the fact that they even had a chance to live and exist, and give them their humanity back in that moment.
Yeah, and that goes to something that I was thinking about when you first posed the question about, you know, basically memorialization, or the topic, or the sort of pushback and the generalization of bad things happened everywhere. So what are we supposed to do? In New Orleans, as you all are very well aware, the markers that were put up a couple of years ago, the addition of more markers and significant areas where things happened that were significant to the history of slavery. The markers on Esplanade that were put up, the one that is only a block away from where Solomon Northrop was sold, is a marker of where Franklin, Armfield, and Ballard's offices were in New Orleans. It's like these things that are there that people who are coming to the city, you know, who are coming to New Orleans for a good time, are also encountering these things. They stop and they read them. And so this idea that memorialization in and of itself is a complete disruptor. Either you need to shut everything down and pay close attention to this, or not memorialize it. Again, you have these binaries where that is not the case. You know, we have examples of it, like the one that Amber just talked about overseas in Germany. And we have examples even within our own city of ways that you can talk about these spaces where significant things happened in a way that, you know, the audience on the whole will choose at what level they engage with it. Some people stop read, contemplate, take pictures in front of these markers. Some people stop and read. Some people just read as they go, you know, but I would not say that in any of those cases, those things are big disruptors. If anything, it's adding to people's understanding of history and potentially, hopefully what it's doing for people who don't know much about it is that it's sparking curiosity about history. What other spaces were involved in this history as people are encountering, you know, or people are on their celebratory sort of experiences in this city, for example? So,
And I think the idea of giving people the choice and giving them the agency of you see, and again, with those markers in New Orleans, there are certain restaurants that have new markers on them that acknowledge the fact that they were part of, they were slave trading spots. And, you know, as I walk into, I think the Napoleon House is one that is marked now. And it gives me, I read the marker, and I have to say that I was troubled when I sat in that restaurant, right? And I it put me in the moment, and at that moment, it made me think about, did I really want to be there? But what I appreciate about it is that it acknowledged what it was, and it gave me the choice. It gives me the choice of whether I want to go back there, you know, and like maybe it's a process for me to learn. And I am more curious about what happened there, right? And so it doesn't mean that I'm never going to go in that space again, but I was troubled by it. If I want to go into that space again, I'm going to have to go through a bit of a process, which is going to help me, you know, in other sites of trauma that I engage in, including Whitney, right? Like I work at a plantation. I work at a plantation. We all work, Amber and Yvonne, well, Vinton, maybe not just yet, but we are at a plantation space, right? So there is a process that goes along with us encountering this history. And some days, you know, you can sit in that restaurant and, you know, acknowledge and appreciate. And some days you're not going to be able to, but at least you're giving people the knowledge and you're giving people the choice, and not just, you know, forcing them to accept something that is, you know, really uncomfortable. Wynton, we don't want to take up too much more of your time. You have been so generous again to sit down and have this conversation with us. So thank you so much again for joining us for, again, a very thoughtful, insightful perspective on how we can move forward, you know, embrace our history and move forward in a path together.
Absolutely. I really appreciate you guys having me on. This was a wonderful, wonderful conversation.
Wynton, how can people get connected with you?
You can find me on TikTok. I am Lawyer Wynton, Wynton. I'm named after Wynton Marsalis. I have the name, but not the talent for jazz. And then on there, it's all in my bio. You can click my little link and it's got all my contact information. So if you find me on TikTok, then you'll find all the rest of my contact information.
Thank you.
We're Amber and Joy, and this has been an episode of Tilling the Soil, a Whitney Plantation podcast. Want to experience what Whitney Plantation has to offer? Come and visit us at 5099 Highway 18 in Wallace, Louisiana, just outside of New Orleans. You can also connect with us on social media at Whitney Plantation on all platforms. Thanks for listening. Funding for the 2021 Rebirth Grant has been administered by the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities and provided by the National Endowment for the Humanities as part of the American Rescue Plan and the NEH Sustaining the Humanities through the American Rescue Plan Initiative. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in this podcast do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities.